The Senate Veterans and Emergency Preparedness Committee will come to order. Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have the habit of reading a short reading. This one comes from Portraits of Women Combat Veterans. It's called When Janie Comes Marching Home. And this is a topic that we have not really addressed, spirituality in the military. And this is from a woman's perspective. In this chapter, I'm just going to summarize what there are many women, whether they were praying for strength to withstand the daily mortar fire or to hold up under the unjust treatment of a commanding officer, talked about their experiences attending church in the desert, singing in the choir, and sometimes having profound spiritual awakenings. For some women, their faith provided them with a rationale when nothing seemed to make sense. As Staff Sergeant Louita Blash told her oldest son when he said, "Mommy, I'm tired of you going." I said, "I know, but you know, Jesus got a plan. He's allowed me to go for many reasons, and plus, that's part of my job." So her son took it with a grain of salt and just did his best. She said it was heart-wrenching knowing that you had to leave your family, not knowing what to expect, praying to God that everything's just going to stay afloat till you come back. And you pray that you come back. You pray that this hurt is over. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Colleagues and audience members of the citizenry, I think we all have to remember that despite the war isn't on the 6 o'clock news, even Oregon has individuals that are preparing to deploy to Afghanistan again, and the war continues to march on behind the headlines. And it's an issue that's dear, I think, to all members of the legislature here. Colleagues, we're going to pretty much go right down the agenda that we have in front of us today. I have another hearing simultaneous to this shortly, and Madam Vice Chair is going to kind of take over while I'm in and out on this. The very first thing that we actually have on our list is introduction of legislative concepts, so therefore I'm going to open a work session. Colleagues, we have three LCs that we're introducing as committee bills. They've all been brought in by outside entities to the committee for consideration. None of them are assured virtually anything other than the hearing or the discussion that's out there. One of them probably will not be referred back to the committee. We'll hear a little bit about that later as we go through the informational updates that we have, and then we'll hear on one of the LCs briefly from Mr. Sansui, who has been coordinating with the Veterans Committee across in the House on an issue that actually has been before this committee multiple times in the past. Council, if you'd review the three LCs.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the first committee LC for introduction today is LC 136. It excludes veterans' disability income from the calculation of child support. It was requested by a constituent of a member. It could be referred to judiciary as well as this committee. LC 137 enables Oregon to join the Interstate Compact on Educational Opportunity for Military Children. That's the LC that Mark would like to speak to. It has been before the committee in 2009 as House Bill 2348 and in 2010 as House Bill 3679. Although this draft is slightly different, the definition of active duty was expanded to include drill duty service members as well, which will benefit individuals who come to Oregon. That one could be referred to the Education Committee as well as this committee. And the third LC is 138, is a placeholder for certain appropriations, not likely to come back to this committee.
And thank you, Council. The Chair's prerogative, I'm going to let Mr. Sansui talk briefly about LC 137 because he has been coordinating this with the House Chair and the House Committee for quite some time. And so this is one that I think we should at least have a quick update on.
Mr. Chair, thank you, President Courtney, Madam Vice Chair, Senator Olson. Thank you for the opportunity. I know 2 minutes. I sent testimony to you that you have access to. So essentially, I can distill this down to maybe 4 points to stay within 2 minutes. There are 1,860 children of active duty Oregon military K through 12 kids that this would help, and there are over 6,000 reservist, guard reservist children K through 12 that this would benefit. The compact essentially just is...
Could you please state your name for the record?
Oh, I'm sorry. Mark Sansusi, Department of Defense State Liaison Office. Sorry about that. The Interstate Compact allows for uniform treatment of our military children as they transfer between school districts and among the states. Some of the things it covers are transfer of records, course sequencing, graduation requirements, exclusion from extracurricular activities, entrance exit exams or requirements, kindergarten or first grade entrance age variances, power of custodial parents when parents are deployed. We, in the fall, the Coast Guard in Oregon ran a small survey of 43 families, and in fact, on a number of these issues, they answered affirmative that they'd run into many of these issues. At this point, since 2008, 46 states have enacted the compact. So we're down to four states, Oregon, New York, Minnesota, and New Hampshire. So we're asking for your help and your support. At this point, we're now covering up to 94% of our active duty military kids. And we work closely with the Council of State Governments, CSG, that you probably all know. Should this be a bill in February, the Council of State Governments folks are listening, and they're planning to be here to support this effort. So I stand for any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sansarin. Colleagues, I just remind everybody that, you know, introduction of legislative council drafts are nobody's in. There is no obligation to vote for it. It doesn't mean support or opposition by many members of the committee. And the reason I had Mr. Sansui come up here is, as you can see in his discussion, this might end up in the Education Committee. So all three of the bills brought to the Veterans Committee for discussion may end up in other committees. And we might have a very brief legislative session in February as far as that goes. Does anyone have questions of Mr. Sansui? Madam Vice Chair.
Chair Bovis, I move that the following legislative concepts be introduced as committee bills: LC 136, dated December 11, 2013, LC 137, dated December 16, 2013, and LC 138, dated December 17, 2013.
Vice Chair Monis Anderson has moved that the legislative concepts just reviewed be introduced as committee bills. And I remind everybody that a vote in favor of merely introducing a concept is not a vote on the merits of it, and it's not indicative of a member's opinion or position. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? Seeing none, so moved. With that, I'm going to close the work session. The three LC concepts will become committee bills. Closing the work session. And with that, we're going to move on to an informational series of informational meetings or updates, the first of which we have the esteemed Oregon Attorney General here with her head of organized crime. Oh, opposition of organized crime, not organized. And we'll ask them to join us for a update on the Fusion Center, its operations, and some of the emergency issues that, of course, we're all starting to see in counties in distress. And you want me to sign these, right? Okay. So I'm going to sign paperwork as you lead, Madam Attorney General.
Good morning, Chair Boquist, Vice Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee. My name is Ellen Rosenblum, and I am the Attorney General for the State of Oregon. I come before you today to speak about the Department of Justice's Criminal Justice Division, the challenges faced by that division, and the opportunities I see going forward. I will also ask my Chief of our Criminal Division, who's seated with me this morning, Darren Tweet, to provide you with a short update as to the status of the Fusion Center, which acts as a clearinghouse for anti-terrorist intelligence and data sharing between the federal government, the various states, and local law enforcement. I'm most appreciative of your time and will keep my remarks brief. Before I speak on specific functions of our Criminal Justice Division, it is helpful to understand how it fits within the larger environment of law enforcement. Our Criminal Division has specific statutory mandates which do not duplicate the activities of other areas of law enforcement. District attorneys do not ask for our assistance except when that assistance is truly needed. Nor do we duplicate the very important work of our municipal police, sheriffs, and state police as first-line boots-on-the-ground responders to crimes in progress. What our Criminal Division does is bring targeted expertise in a number of very critical areas. For example, we provide two expert resource prosecutors who travel throughout the state and who focus on training and support in the areas of DUI and domestic violence. This service is particularly valued in underserved areas of the state by our district attorneys and their deputies. Unlike most law enforcement agencies, we perform both investigatory and prosecutorial functions. As you know, the prosecution of the vast majority of offenses is the responsibility of the district attorneys. A much smaller but very serious subset of cases is prosecuted by the federal government. We operate in the space left between these two, taking primary responsibility for a very specific group of cases, including certain complex financial crimes, aggravated murders, and operations against organized criminal elements, frequently too large or sophisticated to be handled by a single county working by itself. Because the Department of Justice employs investigators working alongside prosecutors, we're well positioned to carry out the level of vertically integrated investigation through conviction work needed to effectively attack sophisticated organized criminals, most often in the form of drug cartels. During my time as Attorney General, I've learned that organized crime tends to go where enforcement is weakest, taking deliberate advantage of cuts to local law enforcement to hide in ever larger shadows, as fewer and fewer sheriffs and police are asked to do more and more across a larger and larger area. I have visited several of our hardest hit counties and spoken to members of law enforcement, often asked to cover impossibly large areas with an active staff of only one or two at any given time. The Department of Justice is fortunate insofar as we have a statewide scope and we're able to move fluidly to the areas of greatest need and respond to the issues of greatest significance without being bound to a single geographical area or approach. The Criminal Justice Division's Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force is one example of how the division fills specific law enforcement and prosecution gaps throughout Oregon. We call it ICAC. ICAC works in the highly technical area of online child exploitation. ICAC works as a clearinghouse for cyber tips, following tips and leads to determine their credibility and their origin, and then pushing that information out to local law enforcement. Over the past 4 years, ICAC has obtained 32 child pornography convictions in Oregon, resulting in a total of 412 years in prison. From 2012 to 13, ICAC processed 2,339 cyber tips and conducted 401 child pornography investigations throughout Oregon. So that's just one example. The criminal division also works to fill gaps in enforcement against drug cartels and other drug trafficking organizations by focusing its effort on using technology to identify, investigate, and successfully prosecute entire drug trafficking organizations in cities and counties around the state, providing support to law enforcement agencies by conducting or assisting in wiretaps, by installing covert surveillance cameras, by installing vehicle tracking devices, by supplying confidential funds and assigning agents, analysts, and prosecutors to assist with these investigations. For example, recently the division led a multi-agency wiretap investigation in Klamath County, which has been plagued by drugs and violence. Over 40 individuals, from street-level dealers to cartel members, were identified and charged with drug crimes and racketeering. The investigation seized over 30 guns, money, and drugs, primarily methamphetamine. Over the past 5 years, the Criminal Justice Division has had similar success in a number of operations throughout Oregon and has prosecuted well over 100 individuals for their direct participation in serious drug trafficking, racketeering, and other types of organized crime throughout the state. Finally, the division will assist with especially complex cases upon the request of a sitting district attorney. Because many of Oregon's counties can go for months without seeing a highly technical financial crime case or an aggravated murder, it isn't really cost-effective or resource-effective to expect each county to employ the technical experts who are often necessary to effectively prosecute these relatively rare but extremely important cases. Our criminal division has this expertise and offers varying levels of assistance according to need, including everything from the technical expertise and training up to assuming full control of the prosecution of a case. At any given time, we're usually handling about 5 or 6 or maybe even more aggravated murder cases throughout the state of Oregon. Unfortunately, I am no longer confident that this level of service can continue under existing funding levels. The Department of Justice lost 2 more attorney positions in 2013, only the latest in a continuing drop in staffing levels from our high of 11 attorneys in 2009 down to our current 6 attorneys responsible for statewide coverage. And there are also similar numbers, comparatively, relatively speaking, with our non-attorney staff at our Criminal Justice Division. So we've seen similar cuts to our analysts, who are often the unsung heroes of the complex investigations, and vital support staff. I fear that this staffing level will lead to the inability to conduct essential wiretaps. We already have a waiting list. Less assistance to district attorneys, less investigation into cartels that have invaded our state, and more serious delays in processing cyber tips related to internet crimes against our children tips often made extremely time-sensitive because of the ephemeral nature of the Internet at precisely the moment of greatest need in the most economically disadvantaged parts of our state. I'm aware of the extreme budgetary challenges facing Oregon and the near impossibility of being asked to choose between so many meritorious projects in desperate need of funding. I would not come to you with this request were the need not severe. I will be requesting additional funding for the Criminal Justice Division in the 2014 short session, and I would like to thank you, Senator Boquist, for your commitment and your leadership on this issue. I know that the dollars are thinly spread and the deserving causes many, but nor can I turn away from the enormity of the need for more support for our law enforcement personnel and county prosecutors. Thank you so much for your time and attention, and I would turn the presentation over to Darren Tweet for an update on the status of the Fusion Center.
Thank you, General. Mr. Chair, Madam Vice Chair, members of the committee, my name is Darren Tweet. I'm the Chief Counsel of the Criminal Justice Division, as you've just heard. Brief update. Since the last time I appeared in front of this committee and spoke to you regarding all of our operations, particularly the Fusion Center, the Fusion Center is an integral part of the Oregon Public Safety System, as I've told you. It acts as an information clearinghouse. It works with law enforcement agencies throughout the state in order to make sure that Oregonians are protected from both domestic extremists and foreign extremists. It is primarily, at this time, a grant-funded program. It's funded through a grant through the State Homeland Security grant, administered by the Office of Emergency Management. And let me just, at this point, thank the Office of Emergency Management for their work on the issues of sustainability for the Fusion Center. They have been a great partner over the past year trying to maintain the program. And we appreciate it, and I know that the Attorney General also appreciates the work that they've given. Unfortunately, as it is a grant-funded program, funded primarily by federal grant money, it is not ever a sustainable program. We don't know what the federal budget is going to be from year to year, and we've seen a history of cutbacks in this program through no fault of anybody in Oregon. And that trend continues. In all honesty, at this time, we don't have enough grant funding to make it through this biennium, except, luckily, we have a loss in the Fusion Center of a criminal intelligence analyst who's taken another job. And so through keeping that position open, we'll be able to sustain the program through the biennium. However, that means that we now go from 4 criminal intelligence analysts for the entire state of Oregon to 3 criminal intelligence analysts for the entire state of Oregon working on domestic extremists, foreign extremists, and organized crime issues. As the Attorney General has pointed out, we are unfortunately driving ourselves to the point where we are not going to be able to sustain this program very much longer, even with the hard work of our colleagues in the Oregon Military Department and the Office of Emergency Management. So with that, I would be happy to take any questions from the committee.
I have just a couple of questions for the Attorney General, or she can punt to you. One of them. And I've seen all of the reports, as both of you are, and visited the Fusion Center and along that line. And I represent 5 rural counties in the Willamette Valley, which aren't part of the 3 counties or 4 counties if you put Klamath County in which the Attorney General's office took over the DA's office temporarily down there. The distressed counties in the Southwest, but I mean, we're facing in the rural portions of all 5 of the counties in the Willamette Valley the exact same problem. You know, we have no prosecutors in the district attorney's office to prosecute crimes. We have no sheriff's deputies to arrest people, even if they had the deputies, and no one to prosecute them if they could. And that's a problem with 36 counties across the state. But specifically, with the legalization of marijuana, which is going to happen everywhere, right? It's north of us and south of us. The business model of cartels and organized crimes is ever expanding in Southwest Oregon, and we're seeing an expansion in human trafficking and other areas that we've never seen before. I mean, can you comment briefly on, I mean, the threat is growing. It's not getting better in any means whatsoever that we see out there.
Exactly. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist. You're absolutely right, and I mentioned primarily drug trafficking cartels. Of course, that is organized crime is wherever the money is, and so it happens that most recently, and I think as on a continuing basis, we are seeing, and I certainly would turn to Darren Tweet for his expertise in this area, but it is my understanding that there are at least another 6 to 8 active cartels, perhaps somewhat related to the one that we were able to temporarily disrupt, I won't say eliminate, in Southern Oregon that are active throughout the state. That very well could be expanded into other areas, including, sadly, tragically, human trafficking. And that is something that we also have the capability to do, especially consistent with our ICAC program. We have the capability and the desire to expand that with the necessary resources. If I could just briefly turn to Mr. Tweet to enhance my comments.
Thank you, General. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the point is absolutely correct. As law enforcement agencies throughout the state face continued budget shortfalls and district attorneys are in the same boat and the courts are also in the same boat, what we are seeing is an increase in organized criminal activity, particularly in the timber distress counties. The best way for me to describe this is the way that it was described to me by a senior law enforcement official and to the Attorney General, for that matter, in Grants Pass, who works for the Grants Pass Department of Public Safety. He was explaining to us the challenges that his agency faces as a fairly well-funded municipal police department when compared to the county itself. And what he said was, the city is Hadrian's Wall for Josephine's County. Inside the city, business and commerce takes place. Outside the committee, it is outside of the city, it is lawless. And that is the concern of both myself and the Attorney General, that in these areas that there are not enough boots on the ground, and that, frankly, the Criminal Justice Division is not a primary first responder. We can't fill that gap. But what we can do, certainly, is identify some of these growing threats to Oregon, particularly in these distressed counties. However, if we continue to see the budget shortfalls that we have seen in the past, we're not going to be able to do that effectively.
Madam Vice Chair, questions?
Yes. I'm not on Ways and Means, and so I assume that you have outcomes or, you know, some deliverables if you're given this money. Can you explain to me what we get to get the most bang for the buck if the money is allotted to you? I mean, I know you reported on number of cases, and I know you reported on number of years in the jail. But to me, part of that equation, and maybe I don't know about what the deliverables are, would be prevention, too, or decrease in the amount of whatever crime is out there. Just comments, since this isn't my area of expertise at all.
Thank you, Vice Chair Monis Anderson. Again, I'd like to turn to Darren. I'm not sure that we have anything to hand you this morning, but certainly this is something that we have a great interest in as well. We don't want to be spending resources when we don't have something to show for it. So I'm going to turn to Darren to kind of give you a sense of what we would be able to accomplish with these additional funds that are set forth in the draft bill.
Thank you, Chair Boquist.
Before you say, the chair has to leave for another meeting, so he's not. Please don't.
I'm not abandoning you. I just have to go. Interesting enough, talk about this exact subject to a county commissioner.
Great, thank you.
And hopefully, you'll come up with money for the double murder they have.
And if she leaves, I get the gavel.
Thank you, Vice Chair Anderson, members of the committee. In answer to your question, we do have, like all state agencies, deliverables that are monitored at the state level. They really surround the number of convictions and the success of the process itself. What we would be able to do with additional funding are several things. Number one, we would be able to enhance the integrity and the sustainability of the Fusion Center, which is an important program that we've talked to you all about. And really focus on intelligence-led policing. That actually is something that's been very successful in other areas of the country. The easiest way for me to explain what we're seeing is, if any of you traveled to Manhattan, New York City, went to Times Square in the 80s, as I did, you saw what the lack of boots on the ground, the lack of paying attention to the details in law enforcement can result in. Prostitution on the streets, drug use on the streets, blight, urban blight throughout the city. Over the past decade and a half, the New York City Police Department has really focused on the small things and led the country in intelligence-led policing, identifying areas of potential threats, paying attention to the broken windows, but also paying attention to large organized crime groups. We're not doing that in Oregon successfully. We're doing that on an ad hoc basis. Our division is able to conduct one or two large criminal investigations a year. If we were able to receive more funding, we'd be able to do more work in that way. And it does directly relate to the safety of Oregon's communities. We were at least temporarily able to have an impact in every community that we conducted a large-scale anti-cartel operation, either through the decreased availability of drugs or through putting people in jail that were otherwise going to commit property offenses or even person-to-person crimes in order to sustain their drug habits, in order to claim their market share of the drug trade in their communities. So that's the short answer to a very kind of very detailed question, I guess.
Well, I'm reading Tom Clancy's Rainbow Six, which is really an espionage type novel. So I'm starting to understand, or it gives me a perspective of what's involved. On some of your cases, do the feds get involved? Do the FBI get involved?
Madam Vice Chair, members of the committee, the answer to that is yes. The federal government has responsibility for mainly interstate criminal organizations. They do conduct operations and prosecutions for in-state-only groups. But we all know what the problems with the federal budget have been over the past few years. They're like every other government agency, and the U.S. Attorney's Office, and the FBI, and the DEA, and the ATF. All of our partners are facing the same situations that we are, but on a perhaps smaller scale, because they're the federal government. And so, yes, they do work in those areas, but there is a whole unclaimed territory, as the Attorney General testified to in the state of Oregon, where there is not effective enforcement. Due to lack of resources at all levels, and our colleagues in the federal government are no different than we are.
Senator Olson?
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Madam Attorney General. I just pulled your budget up here, and it doesn't give me the 13-15 budget, but I see from 2009 through 2013 you've actually lost money in your budget, and it is concerning. One question I do have, when you do a seizure, where do those seizure funds and weapons go?
Thank you, Senator Olson. I'm going to turn again to Mr. Tweet. I think he's in a position to answer that better than I can.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair, Senator Olson. There are a number of different places that money can go. We have a number of different avenues to distribute the money. In a typical case, we'll use criminal forfeiture. And because we're so small of an agency, we really rely on interagency cooperation in order to effectively investigate any case. So we'll usually have at least one or two, but perhaps several, different law enforcement agencies that we're partnered with. And we'll enact or enter into memorandums of understandings, agreements, intergovernmental agreements, regarding the distribution of the proceeds that we seize. So our goal is to, build those partnerships, and we don't claim as much as we even could in those agreements. That's one way. The other way, if we're working in an organized crime case and we don't have partners, then we have different ways of obtaining the money and keeping it in a criminal justice revolving account that's designed for organized crime operations. But really, we prefer to kind of redistribute the wealth. As we said, we're very concerned about the lack of resources with our partner agencies.
I notice here the other fund seems to be the majority of the dollars that you get to spend. And of those other funds, I assume from what I see here that part of it comes from billing to other agencies. Is that where some of that money comes from?
You want me to take that?
Yeah, why don't you take that?
Madam Vice Chair, Senator Olson, no. The other funds are primarily federal funds. We don't bill to other agencies. In my division, now the department as a whole certainly does.
Okay.
But that's the short answer. No, we don't bill to other agencies, and we have some federal grant funds, but we've been trying to shorten those strings, again, because you can't sustain programs through grant funding.
Well, for my 2 cents worth, one of the things the state needs to provide is safety for the people, and I've noticed a tremendous declination of the state trooper officers on the road, and your agency obviously is also suffering from this, and I think it's one thing we need to turn around because as we get into these larger and larger cartels that come up here and find Oregon soil to be prime for their misdeeds, if you will, I think that we really, as a legislative body, need to look to make sure that you have the resources and tools available. And I'll support any action that you guys want to move forward.
Thank you very much, Vice Chair Monis Anderson, Senator Olson. We appreciate that very much, and we agree with you as to how important it is to have our troopers on the road. And we have a close working relationship with our state police in that regard.
Great. No further comments?
Yep.
Madam, I will call you.
What does he call you? He calls you.
He calls me counsel.
Counsel. Madam Counsel, is there anything else on this topic or someone else that's going to speak to? Okay.
Thank you very much for coming. Thank you. And thank you for having this very important committee. Really appreciate your inspiration this morning. Madam Vice Chair.
All right. We'll now go to Resilient Response 2013 and Major Jeff Kopeck. And team.
Good morning, Vice Chair, Senator Olson. For the record, I'm Dave Perret, Oregon Military Department Deputy Director. And with me today is Major Kopeck, commander of our 102nd Civil Support Team. And with him also is his First Sergeant, First Sergeant Jim Davidson. I'd like to point out before we start the resilient response brief that we do have a display out in the lobby that shows some of our more advanced equipment. And if you walk down the steps of the Capitol, you'll see our mobile lab and our command vehicle, and they're set up, and they would love to give some tours to show you some of our capabilities. Gentlemen, I'd like to go ahead.
Good morning, Madam Vice Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Major Jeff Kopeck. I'm the commander of 102 CST. Next slide, please.
We're having problems, technical problems.
A glitch.
And so we're going to have to call media.
If you're able to continue, Madam Chair, members of the committee, the presentation, the projector is not functioning, but we've contacted assistance, or we could pause.
I can continue if you're comfortable following in your slide packet.
Sorry for
okay.
that.
Okay.
Oh, it's fine.
All right, we'll follow in the slide.
Okay, so the second slide discusses our mission. It's to support civil authorities at incident sites by identifying, assessing, assisting, and advising. We have 22 active guard reserve personnel, 18 are Army, and 14 are Air National Guard. We're funded by a congressional allocation. Listed on the slide are some of the capabilities that enable us to accomplish our mission. The next slide discusses the purpose of resilient response. It was to meet the requirements for the OSU Select Agent Program and to foster team building in collaboration with agencies that have the responsibility of responding at OSU in the event of a real incident. The OSU Environmental Health and Safety Department contacted us in February of 2013 to discuss conducting a bioterrorism type exercise that would build on the success of the exercise that was conducted in September of 2011. The scientists at OSU consistently provide us with test samples and scenarios that are complex, realistic, and greatly enhance our readiness. There were three planning conferences prior to the start of Resilient Response 13. Members from all participating agencies attended one or more of these conferences. On the 12th of September, the CST deployed to Corvallis to prepare a biological lab recognition classroom training event and attend a walkthrough rehearsal at Reeser Stadium with the other exercise participants. After we conducted that rehearsal, the CST conducted an internal coordination meeting to rehearse the timeline and execution of our portion of the exercise. The next slide talks about when we began the exercise. On the 13th, our Survey 6 section began the biolab class for hazmat, law enforcement personnel, and other first responders. Concurrently, command and operations sections prepared the unit for responding to the exercise scenario. Once we got our alert, we met with the incident commander, we received his objectives, set up our operational footprint at the incident area, and then proceeded to conduct downrange operations. The downrange operations consisted of, would you like to go with that?
Yeah. proceed through.
Okay, go ahead to.
This is mainly for the public.
That is the
thousands
side.
That are watching this on online.
Okay, so we're caught up to downrange operations, which are at the bottom of the slide. We consisted of operating a joint decontamination line, backing up FBI EOD, and going downrange to collect a sample. Next slide, please. And after the collection of the conclusion of the downrange operations, the analytical laboratory was provided with a sample, conducted analysis, briefed their identification, and the process by which they determined what the sample was. The exercise concluded, and we had an on-site after-action review. We returned to home station, conducted maintenance, prepared our equipment for any possible future call-outs. On 8 November, a formal AAR was conducted at OSU and facilitated by environmental health there. The recommendation of that AAR was to begin planning for a larger exercise with a target date of August 2015. Next slide. The lessons we learned from this exercise, or cooperation between all the agencies, was excellent. Everyone did a great job working together to get this exercise completed.
And are the agencies listed?
The agencies are listed on the previous slides. We had Hazmat 5 was there. FBI provided EOD. Corvallis Fire, Albany Fire, Eugene Fire came up to do mass decontamination. We had the SURF-P, the National Guard's Enhanced Seaburn Response Force, was present.
Sir, if I may.
Yes, please.
You say here in line one that cooperation between the agencies is excellent. Have you ever had an actual response to an actual event and determined the cooperation capabilities to see how everything interacted when it wasn't in a staged scenario?
Not when I was on the team. I'm fairly new to the team, but the team has had several real worlds in the in recent history, and we have always had excellent cooperation between agencies. I've never heard anything negative about the way we work with other agencies and with the way that they provide support and with the way we provide support for them.
The reason I ask that question is that sometimes in the heat of battle, if you will, there could be some integration problem, and I just wondered if that had ever occurred or if everyone knows the position that they're supposed to be when the actual event takes place.
Yes, Senator. Everyone is fairly aware of what roles they play, and during these training events, we do go through that in a very step-by-step, methodical manner so that when there is an event, everyone will react according to their training.
Thank you very much.
And the second bullet, the first joint decontamination line was executed successfully. Usually different hazmat teams will have their own decontamination line. With this exercise, we had members of Hazmat 5, the SURF-P, and the CST manning the decontamination line. That went very well. Third bullet, we integrated well to cover backup and operational duties. It's a requirement anytime you send someone downrange in a level A, level B hazmat suit into what they call the hot zone, is people in the same level of protection have to be on backup. And we did very well covering for each other on that. And then number four, first responder training time is constrained by overtime costs. As a military member, we are paid by the month, and that doesn't enter into our training constraints. With first responders, it's a little bit different, and based on that, we came up with some new training tactics to help maximize their time on scene.
Madam Chair?
And I'll cover that in the way forward.
If I could ask a question, please. Where the training time was constrained by overtime costs, is there any loss of educational value because we don't have enough money to pay these guys to continue what they're doing?
I'm not qualified to answer on that. All I know is they had a time limit when they had to leave.
Okay.
They participated fully into the training up to that point.
Follow up? Is there any follow-up on the training that they might have missed at another time, another date, that they could pick this extra information up, or is it just kind of lost?
Yes, Mr. Senator. We have follow-up training scheduled with the teams that were there and with other teams throughout the state. That's part of our training plan as we work with them on other occasions.
Okay, thank you.
And bullet one on the way forward is conducting concurrent training for the survey section and hazmat team while command and operation prepares the footprint and plan. We did that successfully at the following exercise in Roseburg with the hazmat team down there. While the IC and the command elements were working together to prepare the operational footprint and plan, we had our survey team and the hazmat team downrange at the training site conducting specific training to them separate from the scenario, which paid great dividends. It gave them multiple entries that they wouldn't have gotten if they would have waited for the plan to be formulated. So that was a great lesson learned and is producing results. Then two, we've come up with a new entry concept brief that shortens our preparation time. Previously, we had a brief that takes about an hour to put together once we get on scene that covers all our operational capabilities and what we're going to do downrange. We separated the downrange based on a concept brief, which is just the who, what, how, when, and where of what we're going to do specifically to accomplish the goals the incident commander has for that operation. That only takes about 20 minutes to get put together, gets us downrange about 40 minutes faster. And we use that in an Astoria exercise since then, and that is going to do well for us going forward in the future. And then three, it answers your question. That is scenario-based training with hazmat teams separate from exercises. Our science officer is capable of setting up some pretty complex scenarios, and we send just the survey team out to work with the hazmat teams independently so they get very focused training. Madam Chair, members of the committee, pending your questions, that concludes the brief. As Mr. Frey said, we do have a display in the lobby. We invite you to see that and our vehicle out front. On the slides is a contact phone number. If you'd ever like to just visit our facility, feel free to come out anytime. If you want to view some of our training, give the operations officer a call. He would be glad to give you our schedule and arrange for you to come out and see what we do.
Have we ever had a biologic incident in the state of Oregon? One that wasn't in training, but...
We've had call-outs for incidents that were suspected of biological.
Or any of them, actually. Chemical, radiological, nuclear.
We responded to incidents. I don't have all the information in front of me, so I'll have to get back to you on that. As far as I know, the majority of the incidents we have responded to have had negative results.
Meaning?
Meaning a sample was collected, tested,
and it's not.
It was not. First Sergeant, do you know of any positives? We have responded to homemade explosives that have turned out to be actual homemade explosives.
Okay. Well, do you respond? You probably then don't respond to, I mean, if a truck filled with some chemical.
That would be more in the lane of the hazmat teams. If it's a known substance, they will go out and mitigate the the damage or the spill. Spill mitigation is something we're trained in as hazmat technicians, but it's not our area of expertise.
Okay. Good.
Ship from Japan, the
radiological. One of our more recent real-world exercises is we responded to a ship off the coast. The Coast Guard was tracking a ship that had gotten too close to the Fukushima exclusion zone. We flew team members out. The Coast Guard hoisted them down to the deck of the ship, and we checked for radiation.
Okay.
That's more along the lines of stuff we do. White powder incidents, the Albany Courthouse. We went, took a sample of the powder, and determined it was negative.
Well, I always like to be prepared, but it just doesn't, maybe Oregon is not one of those states where people who really are terrorists or whoever pick Oregon, they pick more populated areas. I just don't know nationwide what a problem this is, although we have to be prepared for it.
Yeah, we are fully prepared, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Yeah.
Your response team is located where?
At the Army Aviation Facility on Turner Road.
Here in Salem?
Yes.
Okay. What would be your response time if there was an incident in Ontario?
Ontario would be, we have a requirement to be out the door with our advanced vehicle in 90 minutes within call out. Our team will follow shortly after that, and after that is just travel time. Our time is based on how long it will take us to drive to the incident.
So you don't have heavy lift capability to fly stuff in or anything like that?
No. The only time that comes into play is if we have to assist other states.
Since the length of time would be so long to get to Ontario or Burns or Medford, what action is taken to secure the area around perhaps biological? I mean, not knowing what it is, what kind of perimeter would you put out and how far would it be to give you the 3 or 4 or 5 hours it takes to get there?
That's up to the determination of the local first responders. They have protocols that they use to secure the scene and determine how far that they would evacuate people. Once we get there, we have modeling software that, based on weather conditions, based on their estimate of the of whatever possible threat there is, that we would advise them further.
Follow-up. So you don't have a rapid response team that could send 2 or 3 technicians immediately out there by air or whatever to get them in to say, hey, this is possibly what we have?
We have trained along those lines. I think, again, that was with the Coast Guard. We trained with the Coast Guard where we flew to Bend and were, again, using the rescue hoist lowered onto the scene. So if there was an emergency of that type, arrangements could be made, but that's not our normal protocol, sir.
Okay. Is there any other follow-up? Is there any other states that have a rapid response team that we don't?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay.
Mr. Senator.
So it's not, it wouldn't be standard protocol to have a couple people that could get there right away and say, this is what we're dealing with.
No, not like that, unless you.
Madam Vice Senator Olson, First Sergeant Jim Davidson with the CST. We do have in place memorandums of agreement with neighboring states, Washington, Idaho, and Northern California. So depending on where the incident goes down, one of those states may actually deploy their civil support team to that area while we are en route to the location, at which time we would relieve them in place and do our piece of the mission there at the incident site.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Council? Okay. Seeing no further discussion, thank you so much for coming. I learned a lot from this.
Well, thank you for your time, Madam Chair.
All right. Let's move on and talk about the public safety answering points. Dave Stuckey, Director of Oregon Office of Emergency Management and Team.
Morning, Vice Chair, Senator Olson. For the record, again, Dave Foray, Oregon Military Department Deputy Director. With me today is our Director of Office of Emergency Management, Mr. Dave Stuckey, and Mark Tennyson, our State 911 Manager, to provide an update.
Good morning, Madam Vice Chair, Senator Olson. I'm Dave Stuckey, the Director of the Office of Emergency Management. Thank you for allowing me to be here today and discuss PSAPs.
Good morning. As Mr. Perret said, I'm Mark Tennyson, the State 911 Program Director with OEM.
Well, Madam Vice Chair, Senator Olson, you have the slides in front of you, but move on to the first slide here. I'd just like a quick review of some of the policy that occurred in the 13th legislative session. We had two very significant bills that that were passed. The first one in reauthorizing the tax, the 75 cents per device tax for principally landlines was passed and extended, and we very much appreciate that. The second one, obviously, Senator Olson is very, very familiar with in the multi-line telephone subscriber system and being able, that's a great public safety policy decision that was made, and we very much appreciate it. In future priorities, we have two. The first one is the equitable collection of all revenue and for every device that can reach the 911 system. And so clearly there is still some disparity between the devices and which device, whether it's prepaid or otherwise, that can actually is actually being collected and put into the revenue that we can pass on to the per the distribution formula and principally the PSAPs. And so that is clearly one priority. I know that there's policy decisions on whether it's going to be point of sale or carrier remit. We certainly are in support of the equitable collection for all devices that reach those PSAPs, and that's our position. The second thing that I'd like to highlight is that we got a budget note from the legislature. Next generation is also a very, very high priority for us. We had several documents that we needed to submit on 1 December, and right at this point I'll turn it over to Mark Tennyson.
Yes, Madam Chair, Vice Chair, Senator Olson, as Mr. Stuckey said, we had a budget note, and I won't read the whole note, but basically it was the agency was given approved conditionally to move forward with NextGen with the understanding that we would engage with the LFO's office and also the DAS CIO's office. And as far as those requirements, it was really to provide what are called foundational project management documents, including such things as a business case, a charter for next generation 911, really just to go through and do our due diligence on next gen and continue forward. So we're in the midst of that right now. We're making good progress. We actually had a meeting yesterday at OEM with LFO and with DAS CIO and went through all the updates. We have provided feedback. The budget note asked us to report back by December 1, and we met that date. So the LFO's office and DAS CIO were able to review those and get back to us, and that facilitated the meeting yesterday. We're on track. We're taking our time. We want to do it right and do our due diligence. So we're on track right now for doing all that, and we'll have some more to report back later on in mid-year of 2014. Any questions on that? All right.
Madam Vice Chair, Senator Olson, the short answer is it's going to be an expensive technological change in how we deliver the backbone for the 911 system, and this is a system that we want to see success in. And so we are working very closely with the Legislative Fiscal Office and with DAS CIO to ensure that we can meet that. We certainly have the stakeholder group engaged and a part of that next generation process, so the users on the ground can be a part of that. And so we believe that we are collaborating and coordinating exactly the way we should, and we will move forward when we have met every and checked every box, and then we'll be able to move forward. And we believe that it's going to be a partnership among everyone to ensure that we get this done correctly and with the best possible outcome that we could strive for. So next slide, transition, Madam Vice Chair, Senator Olson, just a quick PSAP status update. Just a reminder, you've heard testimony before in the past on this, but back in the 1980s, early 80s, we had upwards of 280 PSAPs. In 1995, we had 62. About a year and a half ago, about 18 months ago, we had 49, and now we're down to 45. And so the bottom half of that slide that you see there in front of you is the last four that were consolidated. We have in 2011 and 12, we had some very, very comprehensive studies done by the Kimball Group, phase one and a phase two survey or assessment that discussed both consolidation as well as next generation. And so almost impossible to boil up all that comprehensive study into one particular bullet. But the short answer that we would like to strive for is the top of this slide talks about how PSAPs are consolidated locally as well and naturally. And so the short answer here is that the revenue that our state collects from our citizens for the 75 cents per device that is paying that tax goes into one fund, and we want to make certain that that goes out, and it pays for approximately 25% to 30% of a PSAP operation. The remainder is done by the locals. And so we still believe that there's a great partnership here that must exist between the state as well as the locals in order to right fit and define what the consolidation looks like in the future. But at this point in time, what our office, our position is that this is local and natural, and when locals want to come to us and help discuss this to figure out how to right fit this to make it work for the needs of their constituents, then we will certainly be a partner in that to ensure that we get that done correctly. And so if we can move to the next slide, we have two other PSAPs that have are in discussion now on this. And so this is just an ever-evolving process that we don't anticipate changing. And certainly there will be more efficiencies and more lessons learned in the future when we get that next generation project and we get this new digital backbone in place. And so there's a lot of unknowns in the future, but at this point in time, that's the position of our office. And so with that, Madam Vice Chair, Senator Olson, do you have any questions of us?
I do.
Okay.
Sir.
Thank you, Mr. Stuckey. Appreciate your work on this. You know, I'm heavily invested in it also. As far as the collection of funds and how we get the prepaids to pay, regardless of that, has your budget declined or increased with the proliferation of cell phones? So is your budget going up more and more because we're more and more cell phone use?
I'll let Mark Tennyson answer that.
Vice Chair Moss Anderson, Senator Olson, our revenue for the last couple of bienniums has been flat, and it's now actually starting to decline. It was pretty much around 80, 81 million a biennium. It's down to about 79, 78 now, and we're still seeing the call increase. Our call volume of 911 is continuing, for the most part, statewide, to increase. So that leads us to believe that there is a niche there of calls that are happening, of revenue that we're not receiving today.
Follow up. Could this be due to the lack of prepaids putting into the system but still being able to use the system?
That'd be my assumption, sir.
Okay. So we as the legislative body, really need to address this and fix that. Okay. Now, you know that I've been kind of always looked at to back up PSAP areas so that one could take care of another one. Has there been any other further discussion on that?
In the backup redundancy component of it? Talk next gen.
Vice Chair Monis Anderson, Senator Olson, a great question. And again, there'll be much more efficiencies, including that backup, when we go to a next gen environment. It'll be much more efficient. There are very good capabilities to do that today, but as you know, there's times where we have a problem in a certain area and we have to reroute 911 calls. So with next gen, we'll have a much more robust network and the ability to back up the primary PSAPs.
Could you give us a little brief overlay of the next generation, what it's going to look like? Because one of the things I found was the fact that our PSAPs couldn't talk to each other. It always made me nervous, especially when I have a cell phone. I can talk anywhere in the world. And so it always concerned me that the equipment of one PSAP was not compatible with the equipment of another, so the interconnection was difficult. And Mr. Stuckey and I are on the resilience task force looking at the possible Cascadia subduction earthquake and other cataclysmic disasters. With that said, do we have the capability that if a PSAP or several PSAPs are wiped out, to be able to coordinate and get assistance in there with the PSAPs that are currently available? Which goes back to why I want PSAPs to be able to back each other up. Rather than the consolidation, they can handle their small area, but I'm concerned that if something happens in Eugene, that Salem or Bend or somebody else could be able to dispatch and get stuff in there. Is that next generation technology is going to allow us to do this, or are we still going to be in that nebulous, we almost can talk to each other area?
Vice Chair Ramonis Anderson, Senator Olson, yes, we'll have much more capability to do that. We'll have data. We'll have data centers. We're still determining how that network, of course, will look. That's part of what we're working on with LFO and DAS CIO's office right now, is to define what that network will look like. We will have the ability to take calls on the coast, reroute them to Eastern Oregon. The plan will be, obviously, there's the whole nation is looking at next gen, and states are in various kind of transition periods or, you know, evolving with their plans. But we will eventually have the ability to transfer calls even to another state if we needed to.
Yeah. One last follow-up question. Mm-hmm. Thank you for all of that. I appreciate that because I think it's probably the most important network in our state is 911. Everybody needs it. Everybody Great. Uses it at a time. The question then is, what do we as a legislative body need to do to move this cart forward?
Madam Vice Chair, Senator Olson, we believe that the legislative body is doing those actions now. We are working very, very closely with the Legislative Fiscal Office to ensure that all those requirements are met. We aren't meeting with them monthly, but it's almost monthly, and it's direct coordination continuously on how we can get Next Generation to work in conjunction with DAS CIO, and that CIO office is that's very critical linkage. And so at this point in time, we believe that we are doing everything that we can to ensure that we move the Next Generation process forward and that we're able to answer that budget note sometime in the mid of 2014 this year. And so that's one component. And then the other one, I just encourage the legislature to continue to discuss the prepaid collection initiatives that may exist out there, and mm-hmm. whatever policy decision that you choose to make to collect, so all devices that reach 911 are collected fairly and equitably.
Thank you.
No further questions, Madam Counsel.
All right. Thank you so much.
Right. Thank you.
Thank
all
you.
Right. All right. The last informational hearing is on health care transition issues for veterans. Cameron Smith, Andrew Smith, and Heather Mywald. And while you're coming up, Cover Oregon did talk to me, and because they had so many presentations to other committees, they are not able to present today. That we're so.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Members, they also sent some written materials for the members only, just for educational, for your own information about how their process works, and we posted it on OLIS for your review
you.
At your leisure.
And
it's online.
It's on OLIS.
It's part of your materials.
Okay,
all right.
So good morning, Vice Chair Senator Ramonis Anderson and Senator Olson. For the record, my name is Cameron Smith, the Director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. Happy New Year, first and foremost, and welcome back to the Capitol. Good to have the legislature back teeing up the short session here, annual session in February. Unlike the National Guard and our emergency management and our civil support teams, we don't have any presentations in the lobby or out front with cool gear, but we also don't have a death by PowerPoint, so we're going to give a high level, and we've got a great partnership with our county mental health folks and our county veteran service officers, and looking forward to giving a high-level brief on health care and some of the impacts specifically for our veterans. Again, just as a basic starting point, 320,000-plus veterans in Oregon, about 1 in 10 Oregonians are veterans, an almost unprecedented time in our nation's history that we're serving four generations of veterans across five major wars. World War II and Korea veterans, I kind of lump into the same generation. Obviously, Vietnam generation, about 37% of our veterans, and on up through the Gulf War and then Iraq and Afghanistan today. And with that breadth, both the number of veterans, we have diverse needs as a population, just like all of our citizens, whether education, employment, healthcare, housing. But perhaps nothing more foundational than healthcare for our veterans and their families. And even within that one area, the diverse needs from transitional healthcare needs as our veterans are coming back from Afghanistan, to the skilled nursing that our aging veterans need at the tail end of their lives. And obviously both that physical health component and a significant mental health component. And again, there's not, you know, there are specific differences for our veterans, but also it mirrors often what we see in our citizen population. But a huge emphasis on mental health, post-traumatic stress, traumatic brain injury, Agent Orange for our Vietnam generation, prosthetics, hearing loss, burn. There are impacts from your service on that healthcare, physical and mental health side. We also see a growing need as more women are serving in our military, more unique healthcare needs of our women veterans population. And obviously, we are hugely reliant on the United States Department of Veterans Affairs and the federal VA healthcare. And I was pulling up some of the overarching budgets. They're on an annual budget for the federal VA, $150 billion total funds budget for the 2014 year. About 38% of that is invested in the VA, federal VA healthcare system, so about $57 billion. In terms of those federal VA dollars impacting Oregon, about $1.9 billion across everything from education to healthcare to disability and claims is $1.9 billion flowing back in federal dollars, and about $784 million in terms of that healthcare impact. And similar for all of our families and individuals and citizens, it is both the eligibility, you know, we can kind of think of insurance, but for VA, the eligibility for the federal VA healthcare program, access to it, which includes, as a big rural state, traveling big distances to get to the different facilities or to get to the clinics. Simply getting the transportation is one piece of that access. Also, a concern in the rural areas for staffing some of these facilities, whether the smaller clinics or the Roseburg Medical Center. Sometimes getting the right staffing, whether mental health or professionals or different medical professionals, is a challenge. And also on that access issue, simply navigating what can be often a complex, large healthcare system can be a challenge to get those access, whether making appointments or simply making the links across those different medical fields. Other than eligibility and access, obviously the quality of that care is an important metric, and then also controlling costs and having an efficient system. About one-third of our veterans access the federal VA health care, but clearly thousands more are eligible. And it's a snapshot for the VA healthcare system in Oregon. Obviously, the crown jewel is the Portland VA Medical Center. We're fortunate to have the second large facility, the Roseburg Healthcare System, and we also have in-state the White City Rehabilitation Center down in southern Oregon. I would also note that folks in the Gorge get pulled up into Walla Walla Medical Center. Folks in Ontario and eastern Oregon get pulled into Boise. So there's some unique regional considerations for that federal VA healthcare system. But we're also fortunate to have, just in the last decade, and especially for a large rural state like Oregon, the clinic model, the CBOX, that they've pushed some of that primary care off of Pill Hill and out of Roseburg into the communities. And as I was counting up, about 17 CBOX, the clinics in our communities up and down the coast, up and down the valley, in the metro area, in rural Oregon, that have really pushed VA care into the communities beyond the vet center model that has been a legacy program. There's obviously a big emphasis on telehealth, whether on the mental health side or other appointments that are ability for doctors in Portland or in the regional medical centers to reach out and connect with patients in their community that way. And for those enrolled in VA healthcare, it does meet the criteria of insurance for the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare. But I think it's, again, important, not all veterans are eligible for federal VA health care. It is a discretionary spending program for the federal VA, as opposed to some of the mandatory entitlements that we see on the disability and claims side of the house. And I think my colleagues in the veteran service officer community are more the experts on what that priority group rating is and whether you're eligible for federal VA health care. But flows out of the impacts from your service, your disability rating, your income level. For those most recent transitioning veterans, you get 5 years of access, irregardless of impacts from your service or income level. But a really priority group level rating system that takes what are significant dollars invested in this system, but there's a prioritized effort of who is accessing that system on the veteran side. Given that a third of veterans are accessing the system, we know more are eligible, and it would continue to draw down healthcare resources. Outreach is a continuing emphasis for our state and county veteran service officers and our partnership with the national service organizations, in addition to the broader partnerships. It really feeds into our no wrong door philosophy, whether we're partnering with the community colleges, collecting voluntary data on veterans from DMV and DHS, whether we're linking to Cover Oregon and the Oregon Health Authority, or the private health care providers in all of our communities. One of the catchphrases that we seem to is a mantra throughout all of our partnerships is, have you or a loved one ever served in the military? That gets us the initial, are they a veteran? Do they have veteran status? And then be able to refer those folks as the next step into our veteran services system to see whether they're eligible, whether on health care benefits, education benefits, employment resources, housing resources, and it really runs the gamut. And even if those folks are not feeding into the federal VA or our state benefit system, having providers and health care professionals, whether nurses, doctors, mental health providers, ask that question, have you or a loved one ever served in the military? Even if that care is still going to be within the community and within those community providers, they're going to be able to provide a deeper level of care, understanding some of those unique needs and backgrounds that our veterans and our military families have. And ultimately, it will result in better outcomes for those individual veterans and their families, but a huge economic driver in terms of that $1.9 billion that is flowing back to Oregon, drawing down more federal funds, reducing the back-end safety net services, whether at DHS or Oregon Health Authority, or even coming out of the Department of Corrections. So at a very individual level, the health care benefits are transformational, but it can be also a huge saver on our budget and our community health. And I think we mentioned Cover Oregon has a number of hearings to present. And I think it speaks to the partnership model. How do we approach this work, and where does that responsibility lie? And I think there is... there's something that every state agency is often serving our veterans population, but they don't necessarily think of themselves as a veteran service provider. And I think the responsibility is on the veteran services community, both at the state, the county, and the national service organization level, to organize themselves, structure our own work, both from a staffing and resource perspective, that we can be that partner on a sustained, engaged level. Beyond simply submitting claims up through the federal VA. The partnerships are essential to be able to capture, kind of almost cannibalize the efforts that are going on in all these different program areas for all of our citizens, but specifically those needs for veterans and military families. But obviously the pace of healthcare transformation, the issues both with Cover Oregon and the insurance market, some major complexities, as you know, and it really... So sometimes it's been hard to get that veterans angle in, whether through the Cover Oregon website in terms of getting that question, high level, have you or a loved one ever served in the military, and then be able to get that data to our state level veteran service officers and the county partners. But we are not on our end even structured to really drive deeply with that data as it comes over to us in terms of an outreach. So a lot of good conversations going forward on the visions, on the goals, on the strategies in partnership with the counties of how do we structure our veteran services system, not just to link those that we are currently reaching, but how do we do a deeper dive on outreach and truly be a better partner for the other state agencies and the organizations across healthcare and all of the different areas that we have needs. So I want to hand it over to Andy Smith and Heather Miewald, and then happy to take any questions either now or at the end.
Good morning. Thank you, Vice Chair Manus Anderson and Senator Olson. My name is Andy Smith. I work for the Association of Oregon Counties. And what I wanted to drill down on a bit today would be some of the data on access issues, coverage issues for veterans in Oregon. So just to point you to a resource that I hope that you have that I'm going to reference here in my remarks. National data indicates that in the U.S. there are about 1.3 million veterans that are uninsured. And jump right to Oregon, which is the second page in this chart. And there are quite a few numbers there, but you'll see Oregon kind of at the bottom because, unfortunately, we are, in terms of the rate of uninsured for veterans across the country, we are at 14.3%. There are about, this would include military member veterans as well as their family members. And that rate looks like it's 48th. So you'll see that some states are really much lower, ranges from 4.3% to 17%. And what that means in terms of numbers for Oregon is that we have about 45,000 veterans and their family members that are uninsured. So that means that they're not accessing health care through the VA or their employer or an individual plan. They're simply uninsured. They might be getting treatment. As you know, we have indigent services for mental health, and we have emergency room access. But clearly, the opportunity before us is with the expansion of Medicaid as one key area of change, would be that about 40% of these uninsured veterans, both in Oregon and nationally, would be eligible for Medicaid. That's if you expanded Medicaid. In Oregon, we have expanded Medicaid. So about 18,000 of these 45,000 individuals may already, some of them may be showing up through Cover Oregon. We don't know. But clearly the opportunity is there. And one of the things that we want to do as a county and working with Cover Oregon is we want to track this very closely. We want to be able to measure that veterans, as well as the rest of the population, is benefiting from some of the healthcare changes that are going on. So we're working very closely with Cover Oregon. I mean, we've started that conversation with the support of ODVA. All of the counties are involved in this discussion that moving forward. We didn't really, weren't able to open this discussion earlier, but we have been able to open it now, which we're very pleased about. That going forward, some of the data that we collect with regard to veterans, that we can start to track, again, are we making a dent on this front? Are veterans getting the coverage through Medicaid expansion? So that's up to 138% of poverty. For the other 60%, so that's 45,000 people, a big chunk of those would probably be eligible for federal subsidies as well. We would like to keep track of that too. So moving forward, we think there's a great opportunity in terms of healthcare access for veterans. With the changes at the federal level and within Oregon, that veterans can certainly do, we can do much better for them in terms of their access to health care. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. The only other resource that there's the last sheet in your handout to give you some sense across the state and on a county basis, where are these veterans? So we do know pretty good numbers how many veterans we have. As Cameron referenced, you know, it's 320,000+ in the state. And we do know pretty well which counties they're in. When we get to, you know, where are the uninsured, these last two columns, and where are these family members, these are estimates based on, you know, where they are. They're kind of just kind of linear estimates based on the number of veterans we know are in counties. If they were equally distributed across the state, that's how many veterans would be uninsured in each of these counties. So as you can see, this is useful information because if you're in your communities, you can kind of look around, and these numbers kind of seem to make sense that, you know, these veterans are across Oregon. They aren't just in the urban areas. They're probably in the rural areas, and there's great progress that we can make, and so we want to help track that and measure that for you, and we want to come back with better news maybe 6 months from now, a year from now, to say more veterans have insurance and are getting access to care. Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Heather Miewald from I'm the president of the Good grief, sorry. I'm the president of the Oregon County Veteran Service Officers Association, and I'm also a veteran service officer in Multnomah County. And I guess I thought I could tell you a little bit more about which veterans wouldn't be eligible for VA health care, who might benefit from using or enrolling in the expanded Medicaid. So the main groups that we encounter that wouldn't be eligible for VA health care are veterans who do not have service-related disabilities that the VA has adjudicated and whose income is too high to be in the lowest priority group. So for our geographic area, it's about $45,000 for a veteran with a spouse. That much income would be too high. Another group, and probably the largest group we see, are veterans who don't meet the minimum length of service requirements, which is 24 consecutive months of active duty. After there's certain dates. One of them is in 1980, and there's another in 1981. Prior to that, there was no minimum length of service for access to VA health care. And then there are veterans with other than honorable discharges. So those are the three main groups that we see. And we've had discussions with CARE Oregon about the ability of veteran service officers to help people get enrolled in CARE Oregon. And that's part of what we do. We always refer veterans to services that we know of when we're not able to access a specific veterans benefit. So we're certainly willing to do that as partners, and I think Andy's getting us information so that all of the service officers in the state are going to know who the community partners are. I'm not sure what they're called, navigators or assisters, are in our county, so that we can enroll people who wouldn't be eligible for VA health care but might be eligible for CARE Oregon. And we're talking about having a training so we know who to refer, who's going to fit in those groups. And, you know, we're also sure that, as Cameron said, there are a lot of veterans who probably are eligible for VA health care, which does meet the Affordable Care Act requirements but aren't accessing it. And since we have we've received some expanded outreach grant funds, and a lot of counties have made requests for this, so we're all going to be encountering more veterans and hopefully getting them enrolled in VA health care as well. And if you have any specific questions for me, I'd be happy to answer them.
How does TRICARE fit into this?
TRICARE is limited to veterans who are retired, so that would be veterans with 20 years of service who retired from the military, or veterans who were medically retired. And then there's also CHAMPA, which is for family members of veterans who are meeting certain requirements, like 100% disabled veterans who are, 100% disabled from military service. Their family members can access CHAMPA insurance. But TRICARE and CHAMPA are pretty limited. I mean, there aren't a lot of people who meet the requirements for...
Well, I've heard bad stories.
And Vice Chair Senator Monis Anderson and Senator Olson, TRICARE is also not just for retirees, but on that active duty component on the reserve and the National Guard, and often different levels of TRICARE, TRICARE Prime, and it's often either budgetarily driven, resource driven, again, staffing concerns, whether all, we often had concerns in Central Oregon or Eastern Oregon where some of the providers weren't accepting TRICARE as payment. So just, you had a good insurance, but not access to the providers who would accept it. So a constant battle, I think, which is almost a separate conversation from the federal VA healthcare system for our retirees and our active duty and Guard and Reserve military members.
Well, and again, I heard that TRICARE didn't want to be a part of the exchange, and you know, I don't know the political ramifications of why certain insurance companies don't want to be a part of it, but it makes things, my goal is to make sure everyone has health insurance. And unfortunately, many people don't put a value on health insurance at all, unless they all of a sudden get sick. And I don't know how we can change that culture, but it has to happen, because we know that if someone has health insurance, that they have better health care outcomes and health outcomes. So I think this is, you know, the veterans is a small piece of the overarching problem that we have of making sure that we get everyone insured. But
Vice Chair Senator Montes Anderson and Senator Olson, we're a small slice, but vast amounts of resources, both within those DOD budgets on healthcare and the federal VA. And it is not easy to link, you know, even just linking DOD to federal VA is one challenge in and of itself, much less to our private insurance market, to our community providers, to our own state Cover Oregon system, but is a core mission going forward. So again, how do, you know, a small, at a state level, at the county level, how do we structure ourselves so that it isn't just about us submitting claims up to the federal VA, which is one piece of our work, but how do we truly become a better partner and have the staffing time and resources to be able to partner on this and other, you know, linking to the employment resources that we can draw down, the housing resources. So much untapped opportunity out there, but we could quickly get distracted just going off on kind of rabbit hole chases, but so truly taking the long strategic view of how do we structure our veteran services work to be able to link these systems more appropriately over the long term.
Yes, Senator Olson.
I've had numerous calls from veterans that have run afoul of Cover Oregon, and I was wondering if, A, or one, if you have had those calls, and B, or two, those people that have run afoul, some of them, for example, one gentleman that I discussed this with just the other day said that his medicine wasn't covered. It was $538, and he thought he was covered. Everything was in that he needed to have in, and everything was appropriate. Found out that that coverage didn't take place, and now will be covered in February. So he's without meds for January. I wondered if you've had these experiences, and what do we do to help these guys get through and get their meds for the time that they're not technically covered?
I can say that our office, not as far as I'm aware, we haven't received any calls like that. Obviously, the first thing that we would do is see if they would be eligible for any assistance through the VA. And then, you know, we would go to our county resources and see if there's any emergency prescription assistance or programs like that. But that's going to vary county by county. And in that situation, I can only speak for my county. And, you know, as far any veteran service officer, though, would check to see if there are veterans resources available. But beyond that, I haven't received those calls.
Okay. Vice Chair Senator Montes Anderson, Senator Olson, I would concur. It's no different. Veterans trying to access through Cover Oregon and our insurance market are going to face the same challenges that many citizens have faced, whether on the eligibility, accessing through the web online presence or through the paperwork channel. And then kind of once you're in that eligibility access, whether it's the specific coverage that you previously had on prescription or other benefits, whether the providers that you can go to your same provider of choice, it hasn't been a red flag coming in very frequently, at least to our Veterans Service Office presence. I think that would be mimicked at the county level. But again, tapping into that federal VA healthcare system, and there are kind of those one-off system approaches, whether emergency assistance or grants, but it's the system is not built on the veteran services side to correct what is a much broader discussion on the healthcare side.
Follow up. If I continue to get these calls, who would I call of you three that I could refer these people to so that you have a more in-depth knowledge of what's going on and how to fix it? I don't, other than the fact that I'm their ear to complain. So who would I call?
Vice Chair Senator Montes Anderson, Senator Olson, I would volunteer my two compadres here that you can call them directly. But I am joking, but at some level, our county veteran service officers, for any veteran question, they are the belly button center of gravity in their community and the experts both on linking to the federal VA system or navigating the nonprofits in their community at the local level. So at the state level, we do provide that local claims function largely for the Marion and Polk area. So the state can be another resource, but we are looking hard at how do we augment our county partners and then position the state in that training and certification role to really build what is a regional statewide system.
Well, I would have a request then, Cameron. Could you send me a list of all the county VSOs and their contact information so I could forward that to the people that talk to me?
Excellent. Certainly will, and the Veterans Benefit Magazine that lists the health care eligibility and all the other benefits, some great resources that we have on the web presence and in print materials that we can get for the members to be able to drive out to the citizens.
Thank you.
I've gotten a number of calls on Care Oregon in general, not from veterans at all, but there is a government liaison with Cover Oregon, and they have been phenomenal in zoning in on constituents who are having problems with the system.
Vice Chair Monis Anderson, Senator Olson. Senator Olson, I would be happy as well to be a single point of contact for the counties, you know, for, so a follow-up. So if you, you know, maybe you have a, I don't know, I think you cross county boundaries, or is it you just Clackamas?
Clackamas and Marion.
And Marion, so you have a piece of Marion, which would be Cameron. But I can be a single point. I'm happy to do that because I work with all of the counties and closely with the CVSOs as well as him to kind of fill in some of those gaps and maybe to build some of the stories, some of the themes. Maybe there are some things, then I can engage Cover Oregon to help with that.
Could you send me your contact information?
Absolutely.
Everything I would need. Thank you. Because it is kind of disheartening to hear the, you know, hear the stories, and you guys hear them all the time of what I can do and can't do. And the problem is that without an in-depth knowledge of their record and what they can get and can't get, it's difficult to give them an explanation of why this isn't happening. And so if we could get to where you guys could deal with them on a one-on-one basis, it'd really be cool, at least make it easier.
Great.
Thank you very much.
Well, this is just a small bite of the overall issue on health care with statewide, let alone just with the veterans. But I thank you very much for coming. Madam Counsel, anything else?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Olson, anything? Okay. Madam Counsel is going to do is give us a summary of other chamber and member bills for our information.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, I currently assigned to staff the House Veterans Committee as well as the Senate, and so I'm familiar with the committee bills. And there are a couple of members' bills that I've heard of that I thought I'd share today. On the House side, we may see LC 133. That is a revised version of House Bill 2086 from 2013. You'll recognize it when it comes. It'll be familiar. It's the lottery raffle to benefit veterans. That was originally Cameron Smith's idea. LC 134, also a committee bill on the House Veterans side, is a placeholder for improvements to the job interviews for vets bill. If the improvements can be made, that was House Bill 3207 from 2011. We've got a bill set aside on the House side to try to accomplish that. And then LC 140 sets limits on the amount of each ODVA home loan at $417,000, and their existing loan limit is four. There was an ambiguity, if you remember, from discussions about Senate Bill 34 during the regular session, an ambiguity they'd like to fix. So that's what LC 140 does. Representative Matthews, who chairs the House Veterans Committee, also has a bill to extend in-state tuition to graduate students. So we may see that. We may also see, but it could go to an education committee also, for example. And Representative Wisnett has a personal or member concept, which is will be posted for the HVET hearing. It's a one-time reporting requirement to get some data on use of transferable skills to satisfy other education and training requirements for certification purposes. So we may see in this committee, if they cross chambers, some version of those LCs. And if either of you, of course, had any member bills you thought would end up here that you wanted to.
That's a short session.
Not the short session. And that's all that I'm aware of. I'm sure there might be a couple more. But
great. All right. Well, with nothing else on the agenda, we are adjourned.